Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein Online. It's Monday, July 23rd, 2007, the only July 23rd, 2007, in the history of womankind, in the history of mankind, in the history of canine kind. Glad to have you in on this Monday night, special Monday night edition. Are you ready for some gospel? We certainly hope you are, because we have the president of the Gospel Revolution online, as is our wont on these webcasts, Mr. Michael Williams. Michael!
Yes?
How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you today, Glenn?
I am doing splendiferous, although I have noticed a certain amount of high level of stress in the atmosphere. I don't know if it's just down here in Florida, although I have noticed it from people that I've talked to around the country. Do not know what's happening in the ionosphere, but as it always is with the gospel, Michael, it brings a sense of relief to the heart and soul. Yes, and it does. You know, all kidding aside, this is the wonderful thing about meditating upon the Lord day and night.
Absolutely.
It's not just words. I mean, as you meditate upon our righteousness in Him and talk about everybody's unity in Him, it lifts the soul. It's salvation, in other words, isn't it?
An eternal perspective always saves the soul.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think it's because that's the way that being created by God, I think the soul was designed for an eternal perspective. And when we lose an eternal perspective, I think we lose our full capacity for the soul. I know I do. Anytime that I have lost that eternal perspective, it makes life small. It really does.
Well, people get so wound up in their current situation, which, you know, it's normal and
understandable.
But
it's also not very pleasant to go through the other part that's normal, and that's the results of getting wound up into it and all of the negative stuff that goes on. So yeah, we want to kind of move away from that and get into the eternal perspective, and makes the day a little bit more pleasant.
It definitely does. It's normal, but it's not advisable.
That's right.
1-800-436-3260 is the Glenn Klein Online toll-free hotline to talk to Michael Williams tonight. 1-800-436-3260. Also taking your questions and comments via email at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. That's webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Please keep those brief, as always, and include where you're writing from. We've got a very lengthy one, Michael, that I'll be editing. But before we get into that, wanted to talk initially about the passing of Tammy Faye Messner, who was, of course, Jim Baker's ex-wife of PTL fame, or infamy, if you will. And it's been very interesting to note the difference between her passing and Jerry Falwell's. There is almost universal glowing comments about Tammy Faye Baker Messner. And, of course, she got divorced from Jim Baker after the whole scandal and then married this fellow, I forget his first name, but Messner. And
Messner.
What's his name?
Roe
Messner, that's right. But she has had a different kind of course. I mean, she was on the Serial Life, or the Surreal Life, rather, the Serial Life. She had a Serial Life. But the Surreal Life, which had people like Ron Jeremy on that show, and other so-called sinners. She seemed to be embraced by the sinner community, if you will.
Yes, she most certainly did. And I think that her entire demeanor did kind of pierce the hearts of everyone. I mean, even people who held really hard religious lines. I think when you listen to Tammy, it was you had a tendency to say in your heart, yeah, it ought to be more that way. And, you know, through the tears and the mascara and, she plowed on. I think I was with Tammy, in fact, in 2004 out in Long Beach, California. In fact, she was going the very next day, to my recollection. She and her husband were there speaking at a church that I was doing some speaking in at the time and teaching in the Bible school. And she came, they invited her to come and speak, and people lined up. I mean, the church was never full, no matter who they had, but Tammy Faye was scheduled to speak, and they, you know, lined up out on the streets. You know, she literally had a fan club. And afterward, I had a chance to speak to her just briefly, and of course, she was a bit anxious about going the very next day back to Palm Springs to find out her results on her test. And and that's when, like I say, to the best of my recollection, I believe that's correct, she went back the next day, and we heard that she was battling cancer again.
Well, I saw her on the Larry King show this last weekend. This was her last interview.
Yeah.
Clearly very ill, very emaciated.
Amazing,
and, yeah. And Larry asked her, now she held on to her charismatic and her word of faith and her evangelical beliefs right up until the end, interestingly enough. And but Larry King asked her in an email that came from a viewer, that why she had been so nice to the gay community in these last years compared to, obviously, most evangelical leaders. And her response was that during the PTL fiasco, it was the gay community that reached out to her, that was kind to her. And so she was just responding in kind to the kindness. And first of all, I found it interesting that the gay community would have reached out to her. Of course, the gay community does love divas. There's no doubt about that. We know. But the fact that they did and she responded positively to it, I found fairly intriguing.
Well, it was. And I think that Tammy Faye was a classic example of, you know, I've mentioned several times about the difference between, that when your heart is kinder than your doctrine, then you know what's wrong. It's definitely not your heart, it's your doctrine. And Tammy Faye's heart was definitely much kinder than her doctrine. And the interesting thing is that even though she validated the doctrine, she followed her heart. And she just didn't condemn anybody and embraced people and loved people and truly was not judgmental toward them. And even though, as you said, even though she held to her classic evangelical belief system, as far as we know, she certainly didn't hold to it in its truest form as Jerry Falwell did to his last breathing days. And, and the strange thing about it was, even when we heard about Jerry Falwell, we heard about a very kind, gracious man behind the scenes, you know. And I think the difference between the two, I think probably both of them were very kind-hearted people. But Tammy Faye chose to follow her heart, and Jerry Falwell chose to follow his doctrine.
And she, again, had almost unanimous praise for her heart. And Jerry Falwell, not so much. Not that should be the standard, but I just find it interesting that here are two people that were intimately involved in each other. I mean, Jerry Falwell basically had a hostile takeover of
right.
PTL and apologized to her, apparently. But Tammy Faye said that she had not been in touch with Jim Baker, which I found interesting. She called the PTL days a nightmare and the worst days of her life. And yet the people that were on the Surreal Life with her, the people like Ron Jeremy, and never saw the show, but she says those type of people had been in touch with her frequently during her illness.
Oh, absolutely. They've stayed in contact with her.
Isn't that the way, Michael, that it seems like those that are still steeped in evangelicalism run from relationship and from consistent communication? And I mean, that's kind of one of the symptoms of that, isn't it?
Well, they run from it if it is out of step with their belief.
Right.
Now, they can stay, you know, the many, they can all, I'm sure Jerry Falwell can show you people that he had been in contact with and maintained relationship with for decades, but I'll guarantee you it was people of his own genre of belief.
You know, I had so many friends in the church. I thought they were friends until I started believing differently. Then they pretty much all went away, except for one who came with me on this journey. So all these people that had been in my home and we had spent, you know, just hundreds and hundreds of hours together, literally fled when I decided that Jesus actually was Lord. It's very, very interesting.
And you know, and the interesting thing about it, I think this is would be true for you. I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but asking you, I mean, of the relationships that were terminated, I mean, did you consciously decide to terminate those relationships, or was it the other way around?
Well, no. In fact, I continued to reach out to those relationships and still have, but with little or no response.
Right.
So it's I think it speaks of a massive insecurity and a fear that we might be right.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that the other way around, I mean, that's the same with me. I am not aware of any relationship that I ended because of any type of doctrinal thing at all. And I think it speaks well of the gospel when that is the case, because I don't think it's speaking, addressing any lack of security or that we're convinced that what we believe is true, but I think it just makes that what we believe is irrelevant when it comes to relationships. And that's one thing that I really love about the gospel, is that when it comes to relationships, the gospel really does make what somebody else believes irrelevant. And under the classic evangelical Christianity, it is not irrelevant at all. In fact, it is the main relevancy in the validity of a relationship is having religious views that are the same. Or you might be able to coexist, you know, in separate worlds, and you know, for the sake of you know, public debate and things like that you actually remain civil, but not any true relationships.
Exactly. 1-800-436-3260 is the Glenn Klein Online toll-free hotline. Love to hear from you tonight on a special Monday night edition of the Gospel Revolution webcast. You know, we missed a couple of weeks there, so we wanted to get some extra time in with you folks, giving you a chance to ask Mike your questions. 1-800-436-3260, or you can email us your comments and your questions at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. That's webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Well, the first question tonight comes for you, Mike, from Doug. He says, I've been studying Isaiah for a few months now, trying to understand his messianic prophecies, and I'm having trouble with separating the verses dealing with what Christ would do at the cross as opposed to those that deal with what was about to happen with the nation of Israel at the hands of its enemies like Assyria and Babylon. How do you distinguish between the two? That's from Doug. He says, thanks.
Yeah, well, there is two lines of prophecy, and the book of Isaiah is about Israel. And I did a series that it is on cassette. I'm quite sure we still have it. And it was on it's entitled The Prophet Isaiah, so that would be very beneficial. We went through and saw the overall picture of the book of Isaiah. But not only in the book of Isaiah, but all the other prophets, there's two lines of prophecy. And one was of destruction, and one was of redemption. And you'll find those two lines of prophecy throughout Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah, Daniel, all of the prophets that were foretelling of a time when there would be a redeemer. And the interesting thing about it is that even though there were some prophecies about Israel that, you know, it's questionable about exactly when they exactly when it was speaking about, but, you know, Jesus made it very clear, which is where that I go for somebody to be my teacher as far as to understand, of course, the law and the Psalms and the prophets, in the fact that Jesus said that all the law and all the Psalms and all the prophets were about him. So that gives us a bit of a guideline there. And every time that you hear, and I know that you would see this, and it's the reason it's a bit confusing, is that you'll be headlong into a chapter in Isaiah where he's saying, you know, I'm going to destroy you. It's going to be to the utter ends of the earth, and, you know, the blood's going to flow. And then almost in the next breath, he will say, but I'm going to send a redeemer. You know, he'll bear our burdens. He will take our sins. And this is classic throughout, especially the book of Isaiah. And
remember, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, but where Jesus said that the prophets and the law and the Psalms were all about him, when he's talking about the kind of destruction that's going to come upon Israel, that was a foreshadowing of the kind of destruction that Jesus would be taking upon himself.
Absolutely.
It's a foreshadowing, if you will. So it's actually very consistent.
It is. It is consistent, except when the point came that it was talking about, it seems to be talking about the entire earth, which it is talking about the entire earth, the entire planet, and then it's talking about the redemption of the Savior and of Jesus Christ. And then where history was interrupted and time was stopped was at the cross. So all of those Bible prophecies about judgment and anger and wrath literally were filtered into the body of Jesus Christ, even as he said in John chapter 9, Jesus said, now is the judgment of this world. And if I be lifted up, I'm going to draw all of it unto me. So we find here the incredible revelation of the prophets, and that is that all that they foretold of judgment and anger and wrath, that Jesus said, as you said, Glenn, that's all about him. But the part of the anger and the wrath and the judgment that was about him was that he took it all. And all of the prophecies about the Redeemer and the Savior, that's what he came to do. As we've talked many times, that the very foundation of understanding anything about the gospel is the gospel of peace. If we do not understand the gospel of peace, I don't care who I'm talking to, I know that there is no revelation of the gospel unless they know that God is not angry with anyone. And if they know why God's not angry with anyone. So the Isaiah thing is so very powerful. It's an excellent question. And the pivotal point of the cross, the end of time, the end of the world, the fulfillment of days, the judgment of the earth, the redemption of the earth. And as Isaiah said, that judgment and redemption were all the same day. I think in Isaiah chapter 61, it's just amazing to see that in one verse he literally says that the judgment and redemption would all take place in one day, all of it, all judgment, all redemption. Redemption is not drawn out into a future point. Redemption is not handed over to men to participate in, and judgment was not incomplete at the cross. This is the basis of the greatest fallacy of the gospel of Jesus Christ through evangelical Christianity and through Catholicism that could possibly ever take place. And it is that very thing, is that they do not embrace that what Jesus said, that all judgment would come to an end. In fact, he would suffer all of that judgment because the prophets of old said for sure that there was no such thing as a sin that would not be touched by the wrath of God. But all sin was touched by the wrath of God at the cross of Jesus Christ. So the conclusion of all judgment and the distribution of all righteousness through redemption at the cross to the entire planet was a done deal. It's sealed. It's completely, it is finished, as Jesus said. But that one concept that I just explained is the premise, the lack of that concept is the premise for all misunderstanding of everything about the work of the cross that extends from there. Because once you get outside the cross and you start adding man's beliefs, man's works to redemption, you're taken away from the cross. And once you start preaching of judgment and anger and wrath and punishment in some future date, today, or any day after the cross that was at the hand of God, you are taking away from the glory of the cross of Jesus Christ.
That's Mike Williams of the Gospel Revolution. This is Glenn Klein online for a Monday, a special Monday webcast. Glad you're along for the ride, whether you're listening live or on the archive. We appreciate it. And we've got a couple more email questions queued up, Mike. But before we get to those questions, we want to welcome online your pastor and the pastor of the Freedom Worship Center from Houston, Texas, Mr. John Adair. John!
Yay, gentlemen.
How are you?
I am doing well, thank you very much. Having a
good
nice
evening,
day off
John.
And relaxing and catching up from a very busy week.
Well, John, it's only Monday.
Well, my Sunday and Mondays, or my Saturday and Sunday is Sunday and Monday.
Well, we're glad to have you along for the ride. And as we were saying earlier, Mike and I were talking off the air that you have just been to a meeting of, where was this, in Dallas?
Actually, it was in Denton, Texas, which is just northwest of Dallas.
What famous evangelist is from Denton, Texas? I used to see that address somewhere all the time.
Couldn't tell you.
Not R.W. Schombach.
No, he's in Louisiana, I believe.
He's Tyler, Texas.
He's Tyler, Texas. Well, all right, so you were at a meeting in Denton, Texas, with a bunch of people who believe in what's called ultimate reconciliation, correct?
That's correct.
And why don't you, in a nutshell, explain to our listeners what ultimate reconciliationists believe, and maybe tell us a little bit how the meeting went.
Well, I think the ultimate is the ultimate. They believe that all of mankind is redeemed, though they still cling to the verbiage of saved, so that all mankind is saved. And in that particular meeting, now I can't speak for the association or any denominational type doctrine that they might hold, but in that particular meeting, there were several that varied in their doctrine or in their understandings. The primary thread, I think, was that there was still an accountability to sin here and that you still had the ability to sin, which I think Mike and I and you also, Glenn, have come to the conclusion that sin was defeated at the cross and that we cannot sin at this point, because there's no law that we're measuring up to or that would condemn us.
It'd be kind of like driving on the Autobahn in Germany and not having any speed limit and thinking that you get pulled over for speeding.
Right. And one of the, you know, the first day they were a little upset that I was, at the end I found that they were upset that I didn't do more or any speaking. I didn't do any speaking the first day I was there. And I was just observing and listening and hearing what the people were saying. And the next day, any type of interjection or things that I would offer really came by what I was hearing from those that were congregated together and listening to the speaker and the questions they had. And my heart just went out to them, because it is very freeing to know that it is for freedom that you've been set free, that there is no condemnation, that you are forever accepted, that God is not sitting there meticulously scrutinizing every move and thought and desire you have in your heart, mind, and body, and that he is not against you. He is not only not against you, he is not in opposition to you. And to hear them really broke my heart in some ways and also gave me great encouragement in others. It was a wonderful group of people.
What broke your heart?
Well, when I hear them still, when I hear certain ones, and again, this is not a reflection on their doctrine or even any individual of error, but any time I hear somebody that is still struggling with things that they're doing and feeling condemned over, it breaks my heart. And the reason is because they're in a battle that has already been won, and they're still struggling with something that they can be free, not necessarily from or could be from, but free with. And sometimes you can't get freed from until you get freed with.
Right.
In this particular case, as we were sharing together, one of the things that I heard, if I heard it once, I heard it a thousand times throughout the years in Christian grace, evangelical, non-evangelical, grace-oriented, ultimate reconciliation circles, is, what do we do now? I feel so lonely. I'm not doing anything. I want something to do. And so I tried to encourage them to not throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's very important and necessary to have a firm foundation in the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace. And on that, we begin to build. But what we begin to build on that is in freedom and in celebration and in an expression of our worship outwardly, not trying to get something. And what I mean by that is oftentimes we'll make fun of altar calls or people laying hands on somebody else or somebody praying with someone to receive Jesus. And, you know, as I was talking with Mike over the weekend and sharing this with him as well, it wasn't really necessary for Jesus to spit in the dirt and turn it into mud and slap it on the guy's eyes for the guy to be healed. He was God. He could have healed him without that. That man must have needed that, because Jesus surely didn't need to do that. That man must have needed that. The woman with the issue of blood, she didn't have to touch the hem of his garment to be healed, but she needed that. So sometimes when we hear somebody laying on of hands or praying with someone to quote the sinner's prayer to lead them to Jesus or whatever, we throw that out or we poo-poo that idea, when really it might be that that's what that person needs. And so what happens is we come up in situations like that, and we as a grace believer have it in our heart to do something for someone, but quickly get check in our own mind, oh, I can't lay hands on them, or I can't do that, or I can't do this. That's not doctrinally correct anymore. Well, just as we were free from the doctrine, we're free to operate in the doctrine. And some of my congregate members kind of laugh, because sometimes when I do a wedding, I'll put on a very big ceremonial gown and do the wedding. But again, I assure them, look, there's nothing about spirituality putting on this big robe and gown and going to this wedding. It's about pictures. You know, when the groom are standing there in their dress and the expensive tuxedo, the minister standing there in a tie. You're still in a tuxedo, but a celebratory type, but it has nothing to do with spirituality. And sometimes we do think it's it's spirituality to pray for someone, to lead them in a prayer to Jesus, or any of that. And it's not spirituality. I'm against it at all. In fact, I'm really more for it than against it. And it's helping that to relate or to play instrument where they can receive news. And the gospel is for us for living, not for the on the Jesus.
Hey, John. John, we're experiencing. Michael, can you hear that? I got both you guys having technical problems right now. Patrick is working on it feverishly as we speak.
Was that on our end?
I don't know. Now you sound okay to me. John, are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah. Now we're back with it.
Good.
All right. So you're actually for the ceremony and things like that, John?
For the ceremony. Well, are you trying to get me controversial here?
Sure. Why not? Makes for good radio.
Yeah, what I'm for is people to walk in the freedom that Jesus died to give them. And that if it means to express your worship in a way that might have been condemned through a grace understanding, to be free to do so. If you still want to take communion, take communion. If you still want to worship through water baptism, water baptism.
All right. Wait a second. So when you are marrying somebody, or usually two people, when you're marrying a couple, what are the type of things that you're sharing with them about what they're entering into with the grace perspective?
Oh, well.
Because, you know, when people are married in the church, I mean, this is it. I mean, this is till death do you part. This is you are entering into a holy covenant. And you can't mess with that. But how do you counsel? How do you perform a ceremony like that?
I concentrate on the celebration of finding someone that has the ability to receive the love you have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And that the vows are such that basically I will remain open to receive the love you have. And that I'm committed to offer you the same love without expectation, without necessity to measure up, to put on a halo or to have angel wings, and that whatever life may bring, I'm going to stand by you as your best friend.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just like your question, Glenn, about that to John is like, so do you, are you for ceremony? And I don't think that's the real question. The question is, the issue is not that we are for the ceremony, it's that we're not against the ceremony anymore.
Right, right.
And I know that I traversed that territory for many, many years and was against every ceremonial thing that I ever did, or every traditional thing, and you know, anything that was tied to what I used to do, until I could see those things without them being tied to the doctrine, even though in many cases they are inexorably attached to those doctrines. It's still at the point that we've come to, and I think that a lot of people have grown to this point in the gospel, and that is that we're no longer offended by the ceremony. We could go and celebrate with somebody in what they're doing and not be offended by it, and rejoice with them within the parameters of what they're doing.
For us to be consistent, we would have to come to that point eventually, I guess.
Absolutely. That would be the only way that grace would become consistent. And it's the only way we can really, as the three of us have discussed, I know in the past, and we've come to a conclusion that the only way that we can really reach the world is that these things not be issues to us anymore. That I could go to a baby baptism, you know, and rejoice with some Catholic parents about the baptismal ceremony. Because the moment that you take a stand against these things that are important to people, their ears are closed to you. And I know that John would concur with this. I think the thing that we're moving more and more toward all the time, I think John has done this much better than I have in the most recent years. But that is coming to the point where that, you know, our issue is that we want people to hear at all cost. You know, I think this would be one of those places where that maybe taking a bit of liberty with it, but the statement where that Paul said he had become all things to all men, that he might by all means win some. And, you know, once you realize the gravity of knowing that you are redeemed, and as John has pointed out, the difference between redemption and salvation, to keep those two things from being confused does give you an eternal perspective for this life, and, of course, for the next life, of course. But it is so important that people have that we are able to not be against these things. They are not big issues.
Well, you know, if we're not going to condemn somebody for being a prostitute or for having group sex or whatever, it would be hypocritical to condemn somebody. Yeah. But the difference is, most prostitutes don't think what they're doing is getting them in a righteous standing with God. And
right.
It's, you know, we can rejoice with people all they want and be there for them, but when people do these exercises or these ceremonies and think that somehow it's being specially blessed by God because they're doing it that way, as far as our opinions are concerned, that's where we part company. We're talking with John Adair, who is the pastor of the Freedom Worship Center in Houston, Texas. You can go to the website at gospelrevolution.com. Michael teaches there frequently, almost every week if he's not on the road, and we'll be talking about Mike's road appearances later on in the webcast. But John was recently at a meeting of Ultimate Reconciliationists, and John, you mentioned earlier that it broke your heart in one way, but it also gave you great hope, too. What were those areas where you were finding hope?
Well, the hope that I had was, again, that they were able to come together in fellowship and not all agree together. There were varying points of view, and it just refreshed me once again to realize the necessity of knowing the gospel isn't to get to heaven or even to have a relationship with God. It's so that I have the ability to love, that I can love as God loves unconditionally without having to point out faults and major on the minors, so to speak. So in that sense, it gave me great hope to see that though they may not agree doctrinally or have an understanding that that is cohesive to one another, they are truly holding to one another by the love that they have in their heart from God and giving that to one another. It was really a blessing for me. It thrilled my heart to go to lunch with a young man by the name of TJ, who is pastoring a church in Chicago in his tattoo parlor.
Nice.
And he's got several people coming in, and the ministers of the area are all jumping down his throat and jumping on him, that telling him he's not qualified. And I got to tell you, Glenn, he has just as much a revelation, I believe, of the gospel of peace and grace as Michael and I do. And just as importantly, he has a love for people to just see them walk free.
Well,
and his ministry is just to encourage and to lead people into knowing that God's not against them. He's not in opposition to them.
Right.
And so he is almost brought to tears to just say, you know, I just want the people to know that God is for them and not against them. And I don't know what credentials I need to do that, but I don't feel like I should stop. And I was able to just reach over, grab him by the arm with my other hand, do the sign of the cross, and say, there, you're ordained. I'll send you a certificate.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and and that's true. We physically, literally, spiritually ordained him. And
good job. I like that.
It's not about trying to get him to measure up or to meet our particular doctrine. It's about finding those people that are doing what's in their heart, put by God, and get behind it.
Well, that's the kind of ordination ceremony I can get behind, John. Nice job. Very, 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 very well done. But, Michael, we were talking earlier about Tammy Faye Messner, and Jim and Tammy's son, Jamie, who you're familiar with, is got a similar kind of ministry, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. It's, goodness, I mean, he's, in 2000, he had several tattoos, and now I think he's about covered with all the exposed areas anyway, and does a great job in sharing the gospel. Again, you know, when you hear him, his heart just really is got an understanding. There's a confidence, there's a steadfastness there that is remarkable for having gone through what he did, and I think that he has benefited from every bit of it. It's encouraging to me to see someone like him to go through what he did as a young man in PTL and to come to where he has with the gospel, to know that you can. You know, I survived it. I went through it. Of course, I was an adult when I went through it, and he was a child when he went through it. And the thing that encourages me about that, it doesn't make any difference what age you were when you went through, suffered it, or believed it, embraced it, swallowed it, or promoted it. There's always hope, you know, because there's something so contrary to the heart about modern day Christianity that if you're seeking, I just really believe if you're seeking at all, you're going to know there's something wrong here.
There's something amiss. Houston, we have a problem.
Yes, absolutely. A bad problem. And we are...
You're spinning out of control in the space.
We got to get about to get flung on the dark side of the moon here and never come back. But no, he really has. I've
you were talking about, Michael, about guys like Jamie or perhaps like TJ that John met in Denton. That when people are close, their ultimate reconciliation, they can see the love of God for everyone. They know that God, as John said, is not opposed to them. It doesn't take very long for them to see the full picture, if you will.
No, that's the slippery slope. You know, I think it's just a part of the process. The issue of hell was actually the very first time somebody presented to me the issue of there not being a hell for people to go to now was a person who was believing ultimate reconciliation. In fact, I remember sitting down with a group of them. Now, this group in ultimate reconciliation, they believed that people who were not believers in Jesus, when they died, that they would go to hell, but hell was a temporary place, is what they were teaching. And that all of the verses about hell, they had all of that worked out, and the ones that were Gehenna and Sheol and all of this, they had all that worked out. And my head was just buzzing when I first sat and talked with them about that. Because I didn't know I was headed that direction, actually, when I was studying about grace, peace, and righteousness. And that entire group, I sat down and met with about seven of them. And that is actually when I was talking with them that I think they in their belief, I think that they had a real point of view about Satan and him being reconciled unto God. So, you know, we talked about that and about the fact that Jesus came in the form of a man. I told him, I said, you know, I don't have any opposition to Satan being restored, but it can't be through the redemptive work of the cross because it was for man, by a man, but is becoming God. And so we had a great talk, but my point was that every one of them eventually embraced that this that reconciliation was not ultimate, that it wasn't eventually going to happen, but it had happened to everyone. So it was not something, when we sat down and talked, there was nothing. Of course, I wasn't even where they were at the time.
Right, right.
And they provoked my thoughts, you know, up to, because I saw the points were valid, but the eventual thing was not setting, and so it made me study, and I started looking into it, and that's when I finally came to the conclusion that that reconciliation was complete at the cross, that it was not something that was about to happen, at the second coming.
Right. Well, John, it must have been so nice. We're talking with John Adair of the Freedom Worship Center. It must have been so nice to be able to go into a meeting like that, not defensive at all, and just ready to receive from them as well as to give as well.
Very liberating, Glenn. It was refreshing, liberating. It's always wonderful to meet new people and meet new friends, but also someone that's like-minded or at least in some common ground that we're not in opposition to each other.
Right.
And one of the things that I walked away from there with is, as they were still holding on to the word saved as a synonym for redemption, which we know it's not, when it talks in Ephesians 2:8-9 about by grace that he's saved, that saved is a deliverance or a healing or a wholeness that comes that we experience continuously. And I think what's so cool there is Paul says, even that is by grace, when oftentimes Christendom uses it as a term of redemption. So for us grace believers, you know, we don't have to wince when somebody says, well, I just got saved.
Right.
Just understand that what they said is they just got delivered from having their head in the ground. And that's a good thing. Now, if we take it to mean, well, they're saying that they were going to hell, now they're going to heaven, it doesn't matter. If they want to hold to that, let them hold to that. But we don't have to wince. And it's nice to know that we can all experience being saved, or we can experience our salvation on a moment-to-moment basis. We don't have to die, wait to die, and go to heaven to experience our salvation. We can experience it now, because ultimately, what's really the gospel of grace and peace about? It's reconciliation in relationship with God. And in that relationship with God, the passing from this life to the next is just a breath away. It is an effortless act, just as if walking in relationship now. We can walk in heaven on earth. And the thing is, it's not this spooky spiritual thing that's about that makes it that. It's the relationships and the quality of the relationships we have, and remembering that our freedom is expressed through serving one another. That really is an expression of our free spirit within inside, is serving one another. And you can do that when you go to the grocery store. You can do that when you go to work. You can do that as you're getting your car washed. And what you'll find is the joy of your salvation being released through you, blessing others. And that is just so cool. So being up there in Denton, listening to all these different points of view, hearing their victories and their shortcomings, and at the same time knowing that they're clinging to the unifying factor, which is Jesus did it once and for all, for all. That is the unifying factor, and I think you're going to hear a lot more from Mike and I regarding that, because it really doesn't. Even TJ, he says, you know, what kind of words of wisdom can you give me about the group? And I share this with pastors again and again. Lay down a firm foundation as to what the unifying factor is. It is the gospel of peace and the gospel of grace. And the gospel of Jesus Christ, which encompasses those components, is the unifying factor. And that no matter what kind of clothes you're wearing, how you're talking, or how you're living your life, those are not the unifying factor.
Even if you're tattooed.
Even, especially if you're tattooed.
Or even if you're speaking in tongues, or if you're, being baptized, or having communion.
All right, well, dancing with snakes, we've got to draw the line, but just kidding. John, thanks a lot for your time, buddy. Good stuff, Maynard.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Love you guys.
Love you, too.
Talk to you later.
Peace and grease. It's John Adair, ladies and gentlemen. Michael Williams, you got a personal pastor now, huh?
I do.
That's sweet.
And I'm very grateful.
That's really excellent.
See, you pass up all the rest to get to the best. So.
Down there in Houston, and you can go into the gospelrevolution.com page and get information about where they meet and the Freedom Worship Center. And Michael, you do some teaching there.
Yes, I do.
You do some good teaching, Michael. Good teaching.
On Friday, I'm going to start teaching at the noon hour.
Nice.
And
a little happy hour.
Yeah, it's a happy hour at noon, and we'll get started by about 5 minutes after 12, give people a chance to get there that might want to drop in from work, and I'll teach for about 40 minutes and have 10 minutes of questions and then let people go. They can bring their lunch or whatever they want, and we'll have
You can't eat during church. You can't eat during church. That's disrespectful.
No, Ronald McDonald is welcome at the Freedom Worship Center.
Just no pork sandwiches.
That's
there.
Right.
No, just kidding, folks. All right, we got a couple more questions, so we got a few minutes left. So they're fairly lengthy, but I think they're good ones. This comes to us from Keith from Georgia. He says, "Hello, Mike. I'm particularly interested in a question from the last webcast that was sent in from PJ from Muncie, Indiana. His question was, can you explain the difference between now how you see past fulfillment and the full preterist view of the book of Revelation?" Now, this is what Keith says. "You started out saying both you and the full preterist agree that all Bible prophecy is fulfilled, but then you made the comment that the full preterist believes that this all happened in 70 AD. It did happen in 70 AD, Keith asked, did it not? What is wrong with saying that? That is when the old covenant was taken away. The sacrifices ceased during the configuration of 66 to 70. Hebrews chapter 9a tells us that all the temple cultus was still taking place as of that date. Hebrews was written supposedly around AD 65 or so. It had not passed away in the 35 previous years since Jesus' death on the cross. It was still present and ongoing when the author of Hebrews wrote his book. If we respect the timeline and context in Hebrews, everything does not appear to take place at the cross. He says, as most folks believe, I would argue that most folks don't believe that, but God's plan took some time to accomplish. So he goes on to write quite a lengthy email, but I think we got the general gist, Keith. Michael, did this happen at the cross, or was it fulfilled at the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD?
Well, here's the thing that we're dealing with, Keith. If we settle for this all being fulfilled in 70 AD, is that it was not the power of the blood of the cross. There is no delayed effect of the work of the cross. And if we accept a 70-year delay, then somebody else can figure out another delay. Well, it's not that big of a jump to go to the modern-day dispensationalists, and they still don't believe that it is absolutely complete yet. I just flipped through John Hagee, and he knows verses that are better than I'll ever know, or that you will ever know, Keith. Verses that he says are not fulfilled yet, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen, and he's got this big chart up there. But here's the issue, and that is that the work of the cross, Jesus did not say it's going to be finished. He said it is finished. There is nothing about the work of the cross, even though there were some... the thing that brought the end of the covenant was not the destruction of the temple. It was the destruction of the temple, the body of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the temple that was destroyed, but Jesus said, destroy this temple and it'll be raised back up in 3 days. So the temple, see, that's where we miss this whole focus on Jesus. This was never about the temple. The temple was a type and shadow of Jesus Christ. Why would a type and shadow ceasing be the fulfillment of the truth? That's like saying the shadow stayed around after the image was gone.
Well, it also would be like saying if the religious Jews and the Christian Zionists are successful in building a third temple in Jerusalem, as many of them want to do, and they start sacrificing animals again, that the Old Testament would kick in back again. And that it,
yes,
and that's silly, you know, from our perspective.
If you delay it to 70 years, then there's the open door for it to be restored again. So even I don't care if they build temples in Jerusalem and do them 100 times better and bring in even more blemishless sacrifices. That's not going to revive the old covenant. It's not going to do anything, the same as it was doing nothing for 70 years until it physically came down, which Jesus spoke of himself. Yet the prophets foretold of the time when Jesus would be the one who would bring the end to all of this. You can't say that laws and sacrifices and everything continued in God's perspective. We're not talking about man's perspective.
Yes, it obviously happened. But would it not be accurate to say that when the curtain was rent in two, when the division between the Holy of Holies and mankind ceased to exist, that was the downfall of the Old Testament? Thank God for it.
That was God putting an end to it. Now, they obviously sewed that curtain back up again. for them to have continued, but you see, God did put an end to it. God did put an end to the sacrifices. The sacrifices did end, and God put an end to it, yet the Jewish tradition continued on for 70 years until the buildings themselves came down. There's been many places where Jews have, not just there, but in other places, have practiced sacrifices. And
well, the amazing thing is that the disciples, many of them, were still going up to the temple after the blood of Christ, and they were still sacrificing animals. I don't think that helped them out at all.
No, and it didn't do anything to take away from the power of the cross either. Just because they did it don't mean we do, and just because they did it doesn't mean it was right. And just because the temple lasted for 70 years doesn't mean that it was effectual or that it was in effect. There was nothing except the blood of Jesus that was to bring total fulfillment to the covenant and to install a new covenant. You see, that would be like saying that for 70 years the new covenant was not in place.
Well, for 35 years. I think a lot of people get confused because Jesus made certain prophecies about 70 AD that had nothing to do with the fulfillment of the law, the Psalms, and the prophets. The scriptures, right. He was just telling you, basically, he was warning all those with ears to hear to get the hell out when they saw robes around in Jerusalem. That was very good advice from a friendly guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
John just wrote in and said, just because it took till 70 AD to manifest the completed work of the cross does not mean that it wasn't complete at the cross.
Yes.
If we use this rationale, then we would have to conclude that the finished work of the cross has yet to be completed since there are still others trying to earn their redemption. Absolutely.
Very true.
Yeah.
So, you know, I actually very much appreciate the preterist view, but in its detail, it is flawed. And in my opinion, and that there is just a, it's the Priscilla and Aquila thing for me, that says that they came and they said, we're here to show you just a more excellent way. I don't have a beef with the preterists in that they believe that all scripture is fulfilled is good enough for me. Yet you do run into these pitfalls when you delay it to 70 AD because there's all of these tags that can come on, and you basically then validate John Hagee's teaching on the restoration of the Jewish state as a fulfillment of prophecy. And all prophecy has been fulfilled. There is nothing to be fulfilled. There was nothing to be fulfilled from the moment that Jesus rose from the dead. It was all done.
All right, so this ties into our last question of the evening. This comes in from Lynn from Kentucky. She says, a friend and I are discussing this question. What do you think actually happened at the cross? Lynn says, my short answer from Hebrews 9:26, but now once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. She says, not until 70 AD consummation of the ages did Christ's sacrifice at the cross put away their sin. What do you think? Frankly, Lynn, I think we just answered that. But she says, my long answer is that Jesus' sacrifice happened at the cross, yet when Jesus said it is finished, he did not mean that all of his work was finished there. He still needed to complete his resurrection, his appearance to the 500, his ascension, and then Pentecost. Neither had yet finished his, and I can't pronounce this correctly, but parousia, P-A-R-O-U-S-I-A. The antecedent of it, in it is finished, isn't therefore all his work, but only his sacrifice. Only his sacrifice was finished. What do you think about that, Michael?
Well, again, basically all I could do is repeat what we've just gone through. And the sacrifice is all that it took. See, that's what we're dealing with here is what did the sacrifice complete?
Okay, but what about the stuff that came after the ascension, the revealing himself in a
all of Jesus's interaction on planet Earth was foretold by the prophets. All of his earthly days, all of whether it was before, during, or after the cross, the resurrection, if indeed that was the baptism of the Holy Spirit. I'm not so sure that Acts 2, of course we know that in the book of Acts they experienced a lot of things, but I'm not so sure that that was, as they presumed, was the fulfillment of that prophecy which was spoken of by Joel the prophet, that all would receive this infusion of the Holy Spirit, because this was just a little thing in the upper room, And I don't think that that it was just an upper room experience. I think the entire planet was infused with the Holy Spirit, and quite a profound thing happened. And maybe that was just a, as John was talking, maybe just the symbolic part of it that would give them some clue. But it certainly was not, could not have been confined to just an upper room experience, that's for sure.
Right, and what about, you know, that Lynn mentions the work of Christ that goes on beyond the cross. The effect of the cross, whether it be the ascension of Christ or the revelation of Jesus risen from the dead to the disciples, or the day of Pentecost, if you want to call it that, or whatever, or even what we're experiencing in what we call the gospel revolution today, these are all manifestations or salvations, as John was referencing earlier, of what took place at the cross. The activity or the impact of the gospel continues till this day, does it not?
Well, absolutely. And just because it's having impact today does not mean it was not already finished. And I think that was John's point, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it right now.
Good story, my brother, from another mother. We've come to an end of another action-packed
Glenn Klein. Good questions, and yeah. A wonderful guest.
Yes, we want to thank John Adair from the Freedom Worship Center in Houston, Texas. I almost said Tulsa, Oklahoma.
You just transferred it.
Well, you know, we need a satellite out there in Tulsa. They need some help. They need some serious help in that place. That's for sure.
Yes.
Want to remind everybody about the upcoming Indiana meeting, which is August 3rd through 5th. You can contact Cliff Hazelbaker at 765-914-0365. That's 765-914-0365. Or go to the gospelrevolution.com page where there's information about that. There will be information shortly about meetings in places like Kelowna, Canada, and Calgary and Wisconsin. And, of course, as Mike said, now Fridays and Saturdays, you can check out his act in Houston at the Freedom Worship Center. We're going to do it all again at our normal time on Wednesday night on the Hump Day edition of Glenn Klein Online. So pre-send some webcasts at gospelrevolution.com questions. That's the address, webcast@gospelrevolution.com for Wednesday, and then we'll get to those then. Mikey, thank you for all your time and for your insight, and we love you. I want to also thank Patrick L. Jones, our extraordinary producer and engineer and call screener on this program. Until Wednesday night, this is Glenn Klein Online. Shalom, everybody.